Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Alarm! Alarm! Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, your Second World War podcast of choice. James, how are you?
Well, I'm all right. I'm still suffering from man flu a bit, which is why I'm back home and not in Cornwall.
Yeah, you're back in the Holland bunker, I see.
I'm back in the Holland bunker, yeah. I woke up yesterday morning, I just felt absolutely dreadful. They've been sort of coming on me all week, and I felt really sorry for myself, and I thought, do you know what? I just don't want to be here anymore.
No, fair.
So I got in the car, drove home, sort of sniffing and snuffling and feeling a little bit sad. And got home, so here I am. I had a good night's sleep. Took night nurse that knocks you out. It's absolutely amazing. That
stuff. It's the stuff. Night nurse.
It's the stuff. It's the,
I mean, it's the, if night nurse want to sponsor this podcast, anyway.
I'm working out. I'm feeling a little, tiny little bit more human, but not much. But I'm back in broad chalk.
Great. Well, before we get into what we wanted to talk about, don't forget, ladies and gentlemen.
How are you, more to the point? You know, selfishly going on about me and my man flake.
I'm fine. Had a great weekend. Popped into Duxford yesterday. Saw the Bristol Blenheim go by.
More elegant than one would imagine.
Yeah, more elegant than one might imagine. But nevertheless,
Forster.
Well, yes. I mean, it. You know, I don't know that he had all the throttles on, but it looked like so many of those aircraft from 1939, 1940. It looked like sort of the last gasp of those sort of slightly clunky planes.
Yes, and it's done in sort of brown and green, isn't it? So it's kind of 1940s pattern rather than 1941.
Yeah, exactly. But before we go in, and then I popped into the Air Assault Museum, and I've had a good chat with them, actually. I wanted to touch on that. Well, but anyway, we have Ways Festival, right? Everybody who's listening. We don't do much hard sell on this podcast, but we are going to sell
hardly
hard
any
on
at
this.
All. Hardly any at all.
So We Have Ways Festival for 2024. The tickets are on sale now. And we have a date for you, which we kept back because we there is a hierarchy here. Our patrons, well, they didn't know about it first. We knew about it first. And then our patrons, obviously, after that. The 19th to the 21st of July, 2024, at Black Pit Brewery, which is right next door to Silverstone. You can see Silverstone from it at the top of the hill.
Yep.
Tickets for our Patreons, independent company, are on sale now. And we're offering early bird tickets at a reduced price. There's only 500 of those on offer, and they're going quite quickly, I think. There's also a VIP ticket. So if you come to stay at the Hilton Garden in Silverstone, you get a discount on that. There's a welcome reception on the Thursday evening with me and Jim. So you get to hang out with the cool people. There's exclusive merchandise. There's skip the queue entry to the festival, and there'll be a wristband
speedy
for you.
Boarding.
So for your Thursday, exactly, speedy boarding, and 15% off their discount code at the Hilton Gardening in Silverstone. So we've got the thing up and running. Normally we don't get tickets on sale quite as promptly as this, but we thought that this year we wanted to crack on with things.
Just get organised.
Just get organised. So
programme coming along?
Yeah, there's a programme coming along. It'll be, if you came last time, it'll be more of the same, but more is the important thing.
More of the same, but more. That's definitely the line for We Have Ways Fest.
So we'll see you there, hopefully. So that's the 19th to the 21st of July.
So we brought it a little bit forward from September. So we've done, what have we done? We've done September, July, haven't we?
Yeah, so we're back on July.
I suspect it'll stick with July now.
Well, we're trying to avoid basically
anything else.
Anything else? That's the issue. Is there's a lot for people to do. There's a lot on, and this is just before the schools, the state schools break up as well. It's the weekend before that. So
don't give us any of your kind of "I'm going on a holiday" excuses.
You shouldn't tread on your holidays, lying. Exactly.
And there's pretty good deals for kids, isn't there?
Yeah, there's pretty good deals for kids. Under 16s are free, and it's We Have Ways
Fest. That's the best deal.
That's very, very strong. We Have Ways Fest.co.uk, and we are assembling quite the bill. But What, Jim, you sent me this amazing set of notes to talk about today, which then spun me off into a...
a rabbit hole of Sunday night fun.
And it's the 13th. We're recording this on the 13th of November. And on the 13th of November, 1941, Ark Royal, part of Force H, was sailing westerly, steering westerly, returning to Gibraltar in adverse weather conditions. Force H had been sighted by U-205, who were 0406, had fired three torpedoes aimed at Ark Royal. All the torpedoes missed. Well, there we go. That's all right, then.
Then yep, except.
0645, Ark Royal flew off six swordfish to go look for the, do an anti-submarine search. Then, this is the problem, in the afternoon. And what I think is really interesting about these things go on all day, don't they? These chases and hunts. Mm-hmm. And the sort of incremental sides like chipping away at each other, stalking each other.
Yep.
At 15:40, the hydrophone on the Legion detected an unidentified sound assumed to be propeller noise of a nearby destroyer.
Yes, because you can switch over from normal ASDIC to listening on the hydrophones.
Yeah. But actually, it was U-81's torpedoes. So at 15:41, so 1 minute before, they hear the torpedo propellers, but they assume it's a destroyer, or HMS Legion do, in recorded position 36, 3 north, 4:45 west, just as a swordfish landed, one of U-81's torpedoes hit Ark Royal on a starboard side abreast the bridge, causing a great spout of water to shoot up in the aircraft on the deck to jump.
Hmm.
I mean, bloody hell. Captain Warren was on the flight deck when the torpedo struck and he raced the bridge to take command, but communications within the strip were immediately lost and Ark Royal continued moving ahead and started to list to starboard. The only crew member lost was Able Seaman E. Mitchell, who was the oldest rating on board and was on duty on the lower steering position when the torpedo struck. He was believed killed in the explosion.
Wow. But everyone else got away.
Everyone else got away.
It wasn't a quick sinking. It was a slow...
No. So then they...
Slow burner.
Then the idea is to tow Ark Royal to Gibraltar, and she's lost the following morning. At 0624, Ark Royal's bow had disappeared below the surface of the Mediterranean. So they do what they can to try and keep her going.
They just can't keep her to Gibraltar.
Yeah.
It's got to be a million miles from where Eagle went down.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's losing an aircraft carrier, that when you've got all your destroyer escort. And the reason I got into this is because you want to talk about life on Royal Navy destroyers. And
I'm finishing up this novel and one of the characters ends up on a tribal class. I've always rather liked the tribals, kind of more so than the hunts, because I like the fact that they're kind of bigger and faster and more guns on them.
Yeah,
I was kind of thinking kind of torpedo, morpedo, really. But when you're talking about destroyers, you want them to be, you know, you want them to be bristling with gunnery, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, and so they are. You know, they've got the sort of four twin-mounted 4.7-inch guns. You know, it's 120mm. You know, they're pretty serious stuff. So I've been looking at kind of trying to work out kind of, you know, what my guy's experience would be on the, you know, as a sub-lieutenant in the RMVR, you know, what his experience would be and how to welcome him into a team on a destroyer. And, you know, destroyers are, they're kind of more fun than frigates and corvettes, which are a lot smaller.
Well, look, right, I think we don't do Navy very often, do we?
No.
So I think a thing we're going to have to do...
Is not do all of them, are we?
Well, no, is what's a frigate?
Yes, all right.
What's a destroyer? What's a corvette?
Well, I was thinking what we could do is we could go through kind of, you know, the experiences on each of these classes.
Brilliant. Let's do that then.
At various times, but let's do destroyers today.
Because I just sort of think these kind of ship names, they do get bandied about, it's too strong, but they get used a lot. But, you know, what's the difference? So a destroyer is for, really, it's for escorting capital ships or hunting down U-boats. And escorting capital ships probably involves hunting down U-boats, doesn't it? Those things are overlapped, aren't they?
But also providing fire support, particularly in a kind of, you know, if you're doing an amphibious assault or something, you know, you're protecting Tobruk during the siege or something, and a convoy's come in, you would protect that convoy as coming in and all that kind of stuff. So they have got a sort of multitude of different roles. Corvettes and frigates are smaller than destroyers. They're kind of, you know, kind of 80 meters long, something like that. And they are specifically escorts. You know, they are just escorts of merchant vessels, and they are equipped with lots of torpedoes and depth charges and that kind of stuff. Well, mainly depth charges.
Yeah.
And a little bit of gunnery, but mainly they're anti-submarine things. That's what they do. Yeah. And then above the destroyer, you then got a light cruiser, which is a fairly fast but under-armoured, but bigger. Then you've got a battle cruiser or heavy cruiser, which is, you know, like HMS Hood or something like that, which is, you know, for the most part, pretty well protected, lots of guns. And then you've got a battleship, which is bigger, and then you've got the aircraft carriers. So the big capital ships are the cruisers, battleships, aircraft carriers. And the destroyers are the kind of sort of, you know, they're the kind of sort of multiple roles and nimble and fast. Well, they depend. I mean, they can go from kind of 25 knots to 36 knots, that kind of speed, you know. But 36 knots is as fast as anything you got, really.
So the tribal class you mentioned earlier is capable of 36 knots, isn't it? Which is
They're serious. What Britain's got at the beginning of the war is they've got a whole load of different destroyers, because they got ones that were kind of developed in the First World War. There's a whole new, you know, the V&W class, for example, which is developed from 1916 onwards, pretty heavily armed.
Yeah.
You'd have at least sort of 4 or 5 4-inch guns. You've got all those sort of interwar destroyers. They're sort of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H class.
There's something quite funny about that. There is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H. And then there's O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W.
Yeah, they do go on.
It's quite funny. And rest assured, though, there is J, K, and N. And L and M. So
we can only have 26 types of destroyer, because after that we've run out. But the ones that get developed a bit more heavily tend to have a proper name, like the Hunt class, for example.
Yeah.
So the Hunt class is probably the biggest wartime destroyer, and they're a bit smaller, more on torpedoes and depth charges and less on gunnery.
Yeah.
And they're probably kind of, you know, they really are kind of escort destroyers and anti-submarine vessels rather than the fire support role that the tribals have.
Yeah.
They're a little bit slower, like 27 and a half knots, something like that. Then you've got those town class destroyers, which are those sort of useless 120 American ones that sort of First World War era, sort of, you know, total smokestacks and all the rest of it. The problem with having smokestacks is you can see them forever.
You know,
because they just, you know, the funnel chucks out kind of all sorts of filth.
They're the destroyers that Churchill sort of essentially begs for, aren't they?
Yes, but it's less for the destroyers and more for the kind of getting American buy-in.
That's involvement. It's that they're symbolic.
Most of them end up being gooseberries opposite the beaches in Omaha.
Yeah, yes, exactly. They essentially get scrapped.
So, you know, they have a role.
But they, it's interesting, though, isn't it? The idea is that they're symbolic of America's involvement, and you can see them a mile off. It's almost like if you were writing this, you'd go, that's a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But my guy, he's on a tribal class, and he's on HMS Iceni.
Right.
And they're all named after tribes. And what I've noticed is that they're not named after ancient Celtic tribes. But one of the tribes is Cossack, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, they're Afridi, Ashanti, Bedouin, Cossack, Eskimo, Gurkha, Maori, Mashona, Matabili, Mohawk, Nubian, Punjabi, Sikh, Somali, Tatar, and Zulu. You'd never get away with
Canadian
it.
Ones.
You'd never get away with it these days.
You certainly wouldn't. But anyway, my fictional one's called Iceni. But it's been really, really funny. There's an amazing book. I sent you a couple of pictures from it, where are all the blueprints of HMS Cossack.
Yeah.
So you can see this tribal class destroyer absolutely dissected in minute detail.
Yeah, where, it's extraordinary.
You know, how the room's laid out, where the bridge works, you know, how everything works. It's quite interesting, because when I was looking back over The Good Shepherd, you know, the C.S. Forrester book that we so enjoyed, which then was the one that Tom Hanks made into Greyhound.
Yeah.
And he talks about going onto the bridge and the kind of pilot house behind it. But you don't have that on the tribal class. You have the bridge on the top. Then you have the gun, you know, the director tower behind it, which is a sort of circular thing which can swivel. And then below the bridge, you've got the signals room and the ASDIC and all the rest of it. So it is a door, and the captain's cabin. So it's a different construction. And what you'd have had with the bridge is always open, which makes it really rough. You think, well, why would it be open? That seems crazy. The main reason is so you can see better. You can just see better when you're in the elements, you know, because if you put glass around it, you just get covered in spray. We all know what kind of, you know, looks like sort of salty sea when it sticks and blurs and you can't see diddly squat after a while. So you would add a sort of glass shield in front of you, but your head would be above that.
This is the thing, though, because in Greyhound, he has windscreen wipers, doesn't he?
Maybe that's because they're just American and they've got more modern stuff. I don't know. But they have open bridges on everything. I mean,
or
you know,
it's easier to film.
Maybe.
It's easier to film than chucking buckets of water over Tom Hanks every 5 minutes.
But, you know, on heavy cruisers, on a battleship, you also have an open bridge.
Yeah. You can just see better.
Yeah. I think you don't on an aircraft carrier. I think an aircraft carrier is a bit more kind of...
Yeah.
But, you know, you suddenly think to yourself, well, okay, well, I'm trying to kind of describe what this guy would have to do. I don't really know anything about it. And, you know, what happens on a destroyer? How does it work? How does it operate? How many people are on a destroyer crew, on a tribal class? And, you know, what's the makeup? And it's fascinating. It's so completely obvious. Of course this is the case. But when you realise the incredibly intricate laws and ways of doing things and traditions and courtesies and things which are expected as a young RNVR, Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve, there's a heck of a lot that you've got to remember. And it must seem this incredibly bewildering world when you first join your ship. I mean, you've come from HMS Alfred or whatever, which is a sort of training depot for new officers. And, you know, you've been trained and you've been trained pretty well, but it's a completely different kettle of fish because you're trained for all sorts when you're at Alfred. And suddenly you're allocated to a battleship or a submarine or whatever it might be and you have to do further training. But if you go to a destroyer or a corvette or a frig or something, you're absolutely just flung in at the deep end and you kind of, you know, you've got your little booklet on things that you should do and things that you get. But God, it must be so easy to forget.
The thing I was really struck by and that you've got to bear in mind is this is a 24-hour environment, isn't it?
Yes.
Because the complement, say, of HMS Athabascan, which is one of the, which is a Canadian destroyer. There's 10 seamen specialist officers, including a captain. So you've got your basically the people in charge of the ship. Yep. Two engineer officers, one paymaster, one medical officer, one gunner officer, 110 seamen. And that's because everything's on shift. It's a 24-hour operation. So whatever you've got, you need at least two of him because at some point he has to get some sleep. 30 stokers, 15 engine artificers and mechanics, 9 telegraphists, 9 signalmen, 3 coders, 4 cooks, 4 stewards. In those numbers, you can see the sort of 24-hour requirement, can't you? 50 other men from specialist branches. So it's about 259, I think I totted it up.
Yeah, the kind of noted establishment is between 190 and 219 on a British tribal and slightly more on a Canadian.
The Canadian ship. But that's the thing I was really struck by is that how this is a 24-hour thing, which takes you, you know, then takes you on to how they run watches, which is the sort of the absolute key to how these naval ships are run.
There's also this absolute hierarchy where everyone knows exactly where everyone sits. You know, captain is God, basically. He is in charge. It doesn't matter what rank he is, whether he's lieutenant, commander, or actually a captain. He is the captain of that ship. And so there's a lot of things you should do. So every time you see him for the first time of the day, you should say, good morning, sir, and salute him. And thereafter, you don't need to say that and you don't need to salute him again. But first time you do.
Yeah. It's all very subtle, isn't it?
And the fact that the cap, well, the little detail I found, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, is that the caps are round. Mm. So obviously your head is oval rather than round.
Yeah.
But they are round and they're deliberately round. And so people, you want to kind of sort of move them slightly to one side or to the back of your head so they fit a little bit better.
Yeah.
But that's really frowned on. It's fine if you're able. Because I remember, do you remember that picture of Bertie Packer?
Yes.
That I had. He was the captain of HMS Warspite, the battleship. Yeah. And there he is with his cap on his on the back of his head and another one slightly on his side. That's fine because he's an admiral. He can do what he likes.
Yeah.
But when you're a sub-lieutenant in the RNVR, you absolutely can't. You have to wear it and it presses down on your temples and it's really uncomfortable.
But the people that commissioned this hat, were they thinking, right, what this will offer is ways of ranks expressing themselves?
I don't know. Maybe.
Further down the line.
Maybe, but it's just, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really,
and
really,
also,
really
you're constantly surrounded by who, you know, reminded who you are. So a regular naval person, the stripes are straight.
Yeah.
You know, around the bottom of the sleeves.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're Royal Navy Reserve, they're kind of interwoven braiding with a little kind of dot.
Yeah.
And then if you're RNVR, they're kind of wiggly braiding.
Yeah.
So everyone knows from a glance whether you are
a professional, a pro, or
a temporary.
Or a gentleman, yeah.
But you don't have that in the army.
Oh, they all know perfectly well, though.
You have sort of TD, don't you, after your initials, if you're a territorial. But you know, in the middle of battle, you don't wear it.
Yeah,
But at all times, everyone knows who everyone is in the Navy.
Yeah, but this is because the ship has to operate Completely efficiently, doesn't it? Like a machine.
Completely efficiently.
I mean, there are literally no passengers. That's the thing. For all the hundreds of people on board, there are no passengers. Because it's the watch keeping thing that I think is, it's the watch that's central to how these ships work, though.
Yes.
So you've got the 4-hour watches and then dog watches, which are 2 hours long.
But they're always between 4 and 8 p.m.
Yeah.
And that's to vary the system.
Well, exactly. That's the thing that kind of puts the leap year into the day, doesn't it? That moves it all along one.
Yeah.
Look, make sure no day is exact. The days aren't exactly the same.
Yeah.
You're always moving along, and always moving along the watches. But I think the thing that was most striking in what you sent me was the officer of the watch is responsible for the safety of the ship. He is not relieved of the responsibility by the presence on the bridge of a senior officer. That is really interesting, isn't it? Because that's how you make a thing run by clockwork, because the responsibility in that situation is devolved. There may well be a captain on deck, but the officer of the watch is in charge.
It's his responsibility, and he's just got to man up.
When you read it in black and white, that's quite a thing. You're 21, you're straight out of training, and you're the officer of the watch. Now, obviously, you have to qualify. You have to get your watchkeeping certificate. But the fact is, an admiral comes on deck, but you're the person who's got the responsibility. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, but you're also doing that before you've got your watchkeeping certificate.
Yeah.
And there's a whole load of hierarchy on that as well.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating. So, generally speaking, the first lieutenant, or the number one, he might be excused watches, but generally would be expected to do one. But maybe one a day rather than two watches per day. And in between, you're expected to do other roles. So it's not just about watchkeeping. It's also about learning about seamanship.
Yeah.
You would get trained up on specific areas, although navigation and gunnery required specialist skills, and engineers obviously required specialist skills, but you would be encouraged to kind of
get across them. Yeah.
And you would also have all the kind of sort of complications that you do with bookkeeping. Endless bookkeeping on a ship. You know, from the amount you drink to stores to incoming, you know, being in charge of post and mail, of overseeing signals, of you know, just so much stuff. It's just, it's absolutely extraordinary. The thing about the watchkeeping certificate, which you really need, that allows you to progress up the ranks and become a first lieutenant rather than a sub-lieutenant. But you have to be over 25 or, in exceptional circumstances, over 22 with a minimum of 1 year's service and the recommendation by your commanding officer. And a younger officer would need 2.5 years service. But interestingly, if you're over 30, you only need 3 months.
Oh, yeah, that's a bit...
Well, so the principle is that because you're older, you're more worldly, you're better at looking after a younger crew. You're more responsible. I would say that kind of more or less follows.
Well, maybe, and the men are according you that too, aren't they?
Yes, which when you think that the Duke of Edinburgh was the youngest, as he was, was the youngest first lieutenant in the Royal Navy in 1943. That does make him exceptional.
That is unusual, yeah.
And the challenges, of course, is that, you know, as a, you know, you're a young 22 RMVR officer, and you're the watch, you know, you're the officer on watch, and your big decision is at what point do you contact the captain?
Yeah, when do you wake him up, basically?
It's really interesting. When you look at the movies, all you ever see is the captain on the bridge. But actually, the captain isn't on the bridge very often. And of course, the reason you would see the captain in a movie is because he's on the bridge when something's happening.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you're in the middle of a sort of hunting down a U-boat, or you're launching an attack, then the captain's on the bridge. But for the vast majority of time, neither of those things are happening. You're just trundling through the Mediterranean, trundling across the Atlantic or whatever. And so you shouldn't really be calling the captain. The captain's got other things to worry about and think about. But that's the decision. You know, at what point do you go, no, I can handle this myself? Or do you think, oh, really, I should just sort of check with the boss here? It's quite a fine line to walk, I would suggest, on a number of occasions.
Well, I mean, when we read that Ark Royal thing, the captain wasn't on the bridge when the ship was struck by a torpedo.
Yep.
He was elsewhere because, he had stuff to do. I think that makes the point. They're in the middle of a U-boat encounter. There's a scare on, but he's not on the bridge. He's got other stuff to do.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, say you're an officer on watch and it's nighttime, it's in the Atlantic and you're rolling terribly. You've got to have the crew on hand to kind of sort of lash down, batten down the hatches, literally.
Yeah.
You've also got to know intimately the rule of the road because, you know, you might have an alert, you might need to do some zigzagging, but you don't want to crash into the convoy.
Yeah.
You've got to be absolutely aware of your position the whole time. Pretty complex navigation you have to be completely aware of. It's a hell of a lot to think about. You know, you're big figures. The times where you're just sort of in a dead calm, kind of trundling through the Mediterranean or kind of, you know, it's a summer in the high summer across the Atlantic in the middle of the day. for every time you have that kind of moment, you've got these more challenging moments of storms and nighttime and lack of visibility and all the rest of it.
I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break and we'll come back to this, because there's also the victualling we need to talk about.
Yes.
We'll see you in a second.
Salute big savings this Memorial Day with Blinds.com. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact, and Blinds.com makes it easy. Choose premium blinds, shutters, and outdoor shades, just in time for summer fun. Get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost, all backed by Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Memorial Day sale now for up to 50% off, plus premium doorbusters. Save up to 50% at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to Weird Ways to Make You Talk. We're just going through the life on a destroyer. What technology are we? We're looking at ASDIC. We mentioned the hydrophone earlier.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely get onto radar and ASDIC and all that kind of stuff. We'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah. We should also talk about the roles of the officers as well. So obviously navigation's a key part of it. We were just hinting at a minute ago. But you also have this thing called divisions, which I think is really, really interesting, where the ship's crew's divided up into different divisions. So you have seamen, stokers, yep, communications, all the rest of it. And one officer is put in charge of each of that particular group, known as the divisions.
Yeah.
And it's his responsibility to do the kind of, you know, the pastoral care bit. You know, so if there's a problem, he's got to sort it out. And the crew would go to him with that problem. It might be a quarrel, it might be trouble at home, it might be drunk and stuff. It could be anything. And a captain might call all divisions. You know, that's when you're kind of lining all up on the deck and everyone's out there and he's doing a pep talk about, right, we're all off to Dunkirk, or, you know, we've now got a major operation, we're going to do Operation Pedestal, this is really important, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that would be all divisions. But yeah, you were talking about victualling.
Well, yes.
It's just incredible.
Well, because, I mean, I loved Hornblower books when I was a kid, so you mentioned C.S. Forrest early on. And there's all the stuff in there about how in the Napoleonic era, a captain would literally be running the ship as essentially a business. He'd be given the money by the Royal Navy to run the ship. So he'd then buy the victuals and the supplies. So being a captain and the victualling, they're completely tangled. You know, the officers and the victualling are totally tangled up with each other. Obviously, it isn't the case, but that in the 1940s, captains are, you know, given £1 million and told to run a destroyer. But in effect, that's what they're doing. And obviously, the Navy's famous for the rum issue, but there's everything. There's absolutely everything else.
Yes.
There's the mess book, the quarterly provision accounts, abstract of soap and tissue, the spirit issue, spirit stoppage book.
Yes.
We've talked before about how the RAF is like a mountain of paperwork. And, you know, for every aircraft, you know exactly who's got on it and then who comes back. But consider how many people there are on ships. The sheer paperwork, the sheer churn of notebooks and
the survey note, the gangway wine and spirit book, the short leave book, the registered letter book. All of these have to be kept up.
Yeah.
And it would be one of those officers in between his, you know, when you're on watch, you're on watch.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, you're getting your head down and you're doing these other chores, such as keeping the book, doing the bookkeeping and learning about seamanship and all the rest of it. Yeah. But the other thing I thought was really funny is that most of the ships have a ship's fund.
Yeah.
And which money is raised from tombolas, which in new money is called bingo.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Here's fun. Let's have a bingo. We'll raise some money so we can all get pissed. I mean, that's basically it.
I suppose, yeah. But I suppose, what can you do? This is before DVDs, isn't it? Basically,
yeah. And there's sort of nice descriptions of the wardroom, you know, where the officers would be, where you'd have sort of fold away tables and stuff, but you'd also have shelves on the wall full of books because, you know, it was quite a lot of time to read.
Yeah.
So there'd be all these sort of battered old paperbacks which would sort of do the rounds, a little radio, stuff like that. So a few sort of home comforts.
Yeah.
And also, the whole discipline thing, I think, is really, really interesting.
Well, yes, that's what I was going to say, because you're all living on top of each other. So that must actually be quite, that must require subtlety, actually, in how you deal with it. Being a martinet, after all, martinet isn't, that's a term of abuse, isn't it? You've got quite a line to walk, haven't you? Keeping discipline on a ship. And again, especially because this is a 24-hour rotating, ever-permanent, you know, you keep one watch happy, but you've got to keep the others happy too, you know, this constant sort of turn of the thing. And What do you do with a drunken sailor? That's the
question. Well, it's absolutely brilliant, this, isn't it? So basically, the Navy's very clear on this. You're either drunk or you're not drunk. But there's no grey area whatsoever.
Yeah. Is the man fit in all respects to carry on his duty? If the opinion of the OOW, the Officer of the Watch, is no, and provided the man's condition is due to the intoxicating effect of liquor, then the man is drunk. If yes, then he is sober. Note, there is no such thing in naval law as having drink taken. The man is either drunk or sober.
Isn't it brilliant?
I want that on a T-shirt.
Yeah, no. It's absolutely brilliant. Really funny. And, you know, all these other areas, of course, are, you know, we are focusing on officers here, it has to be said.
Yeah.
But the other area, of course, is when they're in action. And, you know, he's expected to set an example of coolness, imperturbability, resolve, and show his technical and tactical skill at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, which is why you have all this. I mean, you know, that is absolutely culturally embedded at every stage of the armed forces, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that's why when you listen to those recordings of people on Bomber Command missions, how are we doing, Navigator?
Yes, carry
all
on.
All that kind of stuff. It's, you know, but that's very much a part of it. And I've got to say, I find that all that, I can see why that would be a jolly good thing. You don't want people kind of shouting and getting hysterical. You want unflappability. You want coolness, don't you?
Yep.
You need to be clear.
Very well. I see. It's all that.
All that stuff.
The thing is, though, if you have a culture of keeping cool, then you keep cool, don't you?
You just do.
If it's encouraged, if that's the style, then you're going to end up doing it yourself, aren't you? I suppose.
Yes. And inside, you might be thinking, holy crap.
Yeah.
But outwardly, you sort of go, we've spotted a U-boat. We're chasing it now.
Yeah.
Dev charges away. The world is better like that, I think.
Well, maybe.
You don't want everyone being well proud of each other and kind of sort of hugging each other left, right, and centre and kind of being emotional.
You want
imperturbability.
Yeah, you don't want high-fiving, do you? Sink a U-boat. Obviously, there's also, if you're high-fiving each other, where's the pity in war, as it were?
Yes. I mean, well done, man. Carry on. Very well. That's what you want. So they have all the, they do have the, obviously, gunnery is a big part on tribals. And they do have this sort of gun control tower, the director control tower, which is an amazing piece of kit. And of course, you know, thanks to the cavity magnetron, they do have from 1940 or 41 onwards, most of them have radar, which is the type 271 is the most common. And this is shaped a bit like a segment of a circle and a similar receiver. And this is inside a kind of cage-like structure, which is usually fitted just behind the bridge. And obviously the operator of this has to stay close to the aerial and work inside this little sort of cage structure where it's located. But what I think is quite interesting is the aerial on the 271 had to be turned by hand in the direction reverse. So it goes all the way around 360 degrees, but it can't do it again. You've then got to go back the other way. So it's going, you know, it's sweeping one way, but it sweeps the other way, 360 degrees.
This is very interesting though, isn't it, Jim? Because the year before, 1940, radar or RDF in the Battle of Britain is these peculiar things on pylons.
Yeah.
And it's very often presented in the sort of, not the historiography, but the sort of received account as, you know, this sort of Heath Robinson radar that we've only just managed to scrape together and the Germans don't know, so that's all thing. Whereas what that's telling you is that the Admiralty are well ahead on this. They've got the money and they've spent the money, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Because if a thing's fitted in 1941, that means it's well in production in 1940, which means it's signed off in 1939. Because I often think the RDF in the Battle of Britain is presented as this kind of muddled through thing that looks like it's made of coat hangers and plucky old Blighty coming up with a Meccano solution to a high tech problem. And the Germans have got radar that spins around.
They've got Würzburg and Freya.
Exactly, and all that. Whereas in actual fact, a decision has been made that what you're going to need is to prioritize radar technology for the Battle of the Atlantic, because that's your most important battlefield. And also the RDF home chain works, so you don't need to snazz it up and shrink it and all that sort of thing. Works perfectly well. It's got stacks of redundancy built into it, so you're fine. And rather than it being this sort of Heath Robinson thing, it's actually entirely the right bit of kit for the moment. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
And I'm really struck by that, you know, destroyers by 1941 got a cavity magnetron radar that then essentially gets updated, but the core thing of it, the Cavendish Magnetron, doesn't need to change because they've done the work.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no question that the priority for R&D, research and development in Britain, is to win the Battle of the Atlantic as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
What that means is that by 1941, their destroyers are plying their trade across the Atlantic and escorting all these convoys. Oh, really, you know, pretty sophisticated pieces of kit, but also they're pretty sophisticated pieces of kit that can operate, you know, off Norway or in the Channel or in the Mediterranean or wherever. So, you know, they're pretty good. I mean, they've got the radar, they've got Huff-Duff, you know, high frequency direction finding, which you have in the RAF as well. You know, it's all part of the Battle of Britain Air Defence Network.
Yeah,
but this is radio rather than radar. I mean, radar is a sort of form of radio because it's radio direction. But you have to have two separate readings that would take from two different ships to get a sort of cross bearing. But that's how you do it. But most escort groups are able to do this by late 1942. And again, what you need is you need experience. It's a bit like sort of reading signals from radar when you're in the Battle of Britain. The more you do it, the more experienced you become at it, the better you are at recognizing it. Because, you know, it doesn't sort of say a formation of 40 Dorniers coming across the channel. It just says a load of guff on my cathode ray screen.
And experience teaches you how to read it, yeah.
Yeah. And it's exactly the same on a ship. The more you do it, the better you become at it. And it's the same with readings of Huff-Duff. And again, a bit like the Battle of Britain, it's more powerful when it's a sort of collective sum of individual parts. You know, it's an observer core, it's a filter room.
Creating a cross-reference, essentially.
You create a cross-reference. So it's radar and Huff-Duff and ASDIC. And ASDIC is really interesting. It's what we now call sonar. We talk a lot about it, don't we? And ASDIC towed and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But ASDIC is that thing that you have on U-boats, that you have on ships where, you know, the pings and it's kind of has a little sort of wiggle across the screen and all the rest of it. But it's obviously a really, really key part of being on a destroyer.
Yeah.
And a really key part of the Royal Navy. And they've got a whole school for this. So, you know, it's HMS Osprey, which was in Portland and then gets moved to the River Clyde, to a sort of hotel. And it's one of the few naval bases that has carpet in the building on overlooking the River Clyde. But, you know, you would get trained up as an SD, a submarine detector, or an ASCO, which is an anti-submarine control officer. And as the anti-submarine control officer, you would be overall in charge of the ASDIC. But amazingly, it's if you're RVR, you go along that, it's a 12-day course.
Bloody hell.
A lot to take in, very intense, and then back to your ship.
Yeah.
But ASDIC is actually developed at the end of the First World War.
But this is the other thing, is that this is a piece of technology that's been kicking around for a while, hasn't it? And
yeah.
I think what's really interesting about this, and it's not, to be honest, it's not unlike Bomber Command in terms that there are some very long lead decisions about how the campaign's going to be fought long term. You know, those bomber specifications that come out in 37, 38. And there's a similar appreciation. So the Shipping Defence Advisory Committee, they say in 1937, the submarine menace will never be what it was before. So they're saying, actually, we've got a thing ready or on its way that will help, which I think is very, very, I mean, that's very bullish language 2 years before the war to be using. It will never be a fatal menace again like it was in the last war. I mean, that's very punchy, isn't it, as a way of looking at the forthcoming problems.
But despite that, I mean, that sounds incredibly complacent, doesn't it? But actually, they're not complacent because they are developing radar and they are developing all this stuff. And once the war begins, and certain U-boats are still sinking things.
Yes, rather than being complacent, it's them going, oh, we've got this under control. Just you wait and see, isn't it?
Yes, but ASDIC on its own doesn't work. That's the point. Yeah. It doesn't solve the menace.
No.
So although that statement is quite complacent, in actual fact, they're not being complacent because they are developing stuff all the time. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, the capability of hunting down a U-boat at the beginning of the war compared to the end of the war is streets ahead by 1945, obviously.
Yeah.
But ASDIC is fascinating because, you know, the big problem is that radio is ineffective in water, but a sound wave can be detected accurately. And that's the key to it. So you have a little sort of transporter which is mounted under the forward hull of the ship. So it sort of sticks down right at the front of the boat. It's kind of what's called, known as the ASDIC dome, but it's not really a dome. It's like a little sort of nodule that sort of hangs off the bow of the boat right at the front under the water. And that casts this beam out in front of it, but only on a kind of certain bandwidth as well.
There's only so much it can do.
Yes, it can go down a bit. But basically, it's a kind of arc that goes certain degrees width and certain degrees down. And so the key is when you're getting the echo back, that you identify it correctly. And, you know, is it a shoal of fish or a whale or something? Or is it actually a U-boat? And once you, then you also need to work out what kind of, you know, obviously the U-boat isn't standing still either. So you've got to be able to sort of judge the width of it and what direction bearing it's going. And you can do that by kind of twiddling around and taking the different readings. But, you know, it's quite a skilled thing.
Yes, that takes a lot of practice. And you haven't got, I mean, how much time you've got for trial and error is the question. Because error, after all, it could be fatal, couldn't it? That's the thing. So,
yeah.
Is the ASDIC on all the time? Or do you turn it on in moments of emergency or of sighting?
No, it is on most of the time. But, if you're going fast, obviously, if you're going at 36 knots, you don't really want your ASDIC dome so it can retract up into the bow. So obviously it wouldn't be on then. But obviously on a sweep and stuff, when you're doing a sort of transatlantic convoy, you would have it on all the time, I guess.
And what about other people's ASDIC? Is there an issue that if you're close to someone else, you can hear their pings? Or is it?
No, you can only hear your own pings. But, you know, you wouldn't, and also you wouldn't be that close to another destroyer.
No. But noise pollution is obviously an issue when you're listening for things, isn't it?
So, as
we heard earlier with the Ark Royal, they with the hydrophone, they hear the torpedoes' propellers. They think it's something else. I mean, the margin for error, the trial and error, is the error is fatal, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and this is and the ASCO and the SD, the submarine detector, and the anti-submarine control officer, they have to decide whether the Echo is a submarine or a possible submarine or not a submarine. And obviously, you know, stakes are possibly high on this. And at night or in poor visibility, the ASDIC operator, you know, might go over to the hydrophone effect, whereby he's no longer transmitting, but instead listening to the noise of the U-boat's props, engine, and movements. And, you know, you might hear different types of noises. So a whistle, for example, a 1 or 2 second little sort of whistle, that's usually fish, but a much longer one would be more likely to be a submarine, and a sub sounds much more like a sort of creaking hinge.
Yeah. God.
You know, under the water. Or is that a whale communicating? I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's very, very difficult.
Obviously, whenever we look at any of the what it's like at the sharp ends, I come away thinking, well, I don't like the sound of that. But I don't like the sound of a lot of this.
No.
Seems awfully like hard work.
I mean, I always used to think, well, you know, being on a destroyer would be the best job, really, because, you know, you get to see lots of facts, you do lots of different things, you know, you feel like you've done your bit, but chances of getting hit are probably, you know, quite small, really.
Yeah.
But then you realise that kind of half the destroyers in the war got sunk.
Yeah. And then I thought what was amazing about the Ark Royal is only one crewman was killed. You know, 1,500 people on an aircraft carrier or something. That's quite good odds in that instance. But you just don't know, do you? This I think always the thing with when ships go down is that sometimes it's three people survive out of a ship's complement, sort of 1,500 people, or plenty of them do, and it just seems to be a complete crapshoot, doesn't it? If you are in trouble, there's just no way of knowing, is there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been reading. There was a book. The only tribal class that still survives is HMCS, His Majesty's Canadian ship Hyder, which is is now a museum ship in Ontario. And there was a book written about it, about the Hyder, which was launched in 1943 and was still going at the end of the war. And a book was written just after the war, drawing on all the kind of guys' experiences and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously when Hyder kind of goes to commission, a lot of the crew have been on other ships.
Yeah.
So the new guys are sitting, tell us some stories, tell us some yards. And all of them have kind of, you know, been sunk at some point. And there's a lovely line. It says, many of the men could have told similar stories, but the survivors seldom talked about their experiences unless it was to recall some humorous incident, like the time one of the officers now on board had been torpedoed in a corvette. He was in his bunk, related the coxswain, in pyjamas, the only man in the ship with his clothes off. He woke up when the torpedo came in and jumped for the ladder. She was going down fast. He didn't wait for a life jacket or anything else. Seeing a raft about 100 yards off, he dived for the tide and swam to it. He must have beat the record, he was going so fast. He climbs aboard and looks around. Hello, boys, he says. It's kind of cold here. And with that, he starts to button up his wet pyjamas. Isn't that great? And it's amazing how many people seem to have stories of being on a raft or being in a lifeboat, or it's a bit like being in the tank. At some point, you know, the chance your ship will get hit.
Yeah.
And you've just got to kind of suck it up, you know, and a bit like a tank, you know, whether you die or get incinerated or get out of it, alive. Yeah. It's kind of in the lap of the gods.
But if you are, you know, if you are in the water, you might be covered in oil.
Yes.
And obviously that means climbing onto a raft might be very, very difficult because you're stuck with oil and all that. And it might be covered in oil too. And the cold, end up going back to the cruel sea, really. And those images of men in the water. I mean, it's terrifying. The whole thing's absolutely... I mean, I'm going off it now, Jim.
Well, there's a very nice... we should probably end with this. There's a very nice quote from Ludovic Kennedy, who some people might remember. And he wrote a book called Sub-Lieutenant, which I think he published in 1941, 42 or something. But it's about sort of early days. So it's Norway and, you know, early convoys and all that kind of stuff. And at one point after the Norway campaign, they're based up at Scapa, up in Scotland, so they're doing kind of short patrol work, really. And he says, sometimes we went to sea for 2 or 3 days anti-submarine patrol. It was fun if the weather was fine. I remember some happy middle watches on the bridge where the sea was calm and night bright with stars. Leaning on the front of the bridge, drinking cups of cocoa the messenger brought up from time to time, I used to discuss many subjects with my fellow officer of the watch. Sex, religion, the Navy, literature, art and the human emotions. One got to know one's messmates best that way. But there were other watches when the bows plunged furiously into the hard sea, throwing sheets of spray over the bridge. The cocoa was late and lukewarm. The captain was in a bad temper. One started the zigzag the wrong way and threw everyone else out. Those watches were not so pleasant. And then, of course, there's the cruel sea.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, very amazingly evocative. Well, thanks, Jim, because, you know, we don't do enough Navy. We're going to have to do a frigate next.
Yeah, or a cruiser or something. But we've got to do the Battle of the North Cape as well.
Yeah, we do, yeah. With lots to do. There's always more. There's always more.
But more always Navy, more. I think, generally.
Yeah, more Navy. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Don't forget, July the 19th to the 21st, we have Ways Fest. We have waysfest.co.uk, and we promise more Navy at that festival, don't we, Jim? There will also be the occasional Wrong War talk at We Have Ways Fest next year, where people will talk about, I don't know, Waterloo or something like that.
A little bit, not too much, just a little bit.
Just a little bit, because some of it's interesting. Anyway, we'll see you all very soon. Thanks for listening. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnand here from the Goal Hanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the Founding Fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes. But they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.